Good evening, everybody. It's very nice to see a full house and welcome everyone to the LSC and to this evening's debate on can free trade promote development or is fair trade the answer? We have a very distinguished panel of expert speakers on this subject. On my left is Harriet Lamb, who is the Executive Director of the Fair Trade Foundation. Next to me is Alex Singleton, who is President of the Globalization Institute. And on my far right is Professor Tony Venables, who is Professor of International Economics at the LSC and has just taken up an appointment as Chief Economist at the Department for International Development. He will be speaking this evening in his capacity as a professor at the LSC. Everybody else will be speaking in their full capacity. Anyway, this is a very important topic and one that arouses a lot of passion. And some of you may have seen this advert recently that was sponsored by the Cooperative Bank and Christian Aid, which boldly states that there's nothing free about free trade. Well, we'll find out. Earlier this year, there was also a special issue in the New Statesman, which was devoted to fair trade. And in it, there was an interview with Peter Mandelson, the European Trade Commissioner, who has called for both freer and fairer trade, his view being that trade can be both fair and free. But can fair trade be free, and can free trade be fair, and how can either of these promote development? So I'd like to open up the debate now, and I will ask each speaker to speak for about 10 or 15 minutes, and at the end, I'll open it up for questions and comments. So first, I'd like to ask Harriet Lamb to speak first from the Fair Trade Foundation. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everybody. Can you hear me if I talk like that? Can you hear me at the top? Am I speaking into the microphone? Great. Good evening. Well, free market economics has some powerful backers. Before George Bush was elected, he complained that too many imports into this country come from abroad. And based on that in-depth analysis of international trade, declared himself ready to fight aggressively for free trade, and he has been ever since. just so long as free trade is for everyone else except for US steelworkers or cotton or rice or sugar farmers. And despite such glaring hypocrisies, the ideology of the free market has been driven through international trade policy ever since the 1980s. And have those efforts been successful in promoting trade? Undoubtedly, yes. In 2000, total trade was 22 times the level it had been in 1950. Has that free trade been successful in promoting development? Not at all. Some countries have, of course, seen strong economic growth, but nearly always those countries have first built strong economic bases through protectionism, examples being India or China or South Korea. And meanwhile, statistic after statistic chronicles rising global inequalities, Africa's falling share of world trade, persistent and rising poverty. A recent report by Christian Aid argues that trade liberalisation has cost sub-Saharan Africa some $272 billion US dollars over the past years. Just to give you one concrete example of what lies behind those mind-numbing statistics, many farmers in Mozambique grow cashew nuts, and they used to process those cashew nuts in Mozambican factories. Until the IMF made a condition of getting a loan, the liberalisation of the sector, the tariff barriers were lifted. Now, I don't think you need a PhD at the LSE to work out what happened next. Collapse of the Mozambican cashew nut processing industry. Those nuts are now exported and processed elsewhere in the world, the value added being therefore somewhere else in the world. And even the IMF and the World Bank have admitted it was a mistake. The policy has been reversed, but the damage has been done. And the factories are rusting. To give you another example, Ghana was forced to liberalise as an IMF loan condition in 2003. As a result, local rice production collapsed, and the US now provides 40% of Ghana's rice. Now, that may be free trade, but it's not development by any stretch of the definition. In other words, free trade is not ending poverty. Indeed, poverty is persisting not only despite free trade, but because of it. Because free trade has been forced onto developing countries as a straitjacket. Free trade should be a tool, it should be a means to reach an end. And the problem is that it's become an end in itself, which is patently absurd. It's like saying air travel is always best and everyone must always travel by plane. Now, sometimes flying might be quickest, but it depends on whether you're going to Australia or across London. It depends if your criteria are speed, cost, environmental damage, quality of the meals, or indeed if you want a gourmet meal at all. Clearly, the end we have in sight is development, and all governments have signed up to very ambitious Millennium Development Goals. And if we want trade to play a part in that, and this round of world trade talks is specifically called the development round, it's not called the liberalisation round, it's called the development round, then obviously we have to have policies designed to fit that objective. And if the objective is development, then sometimes you need trade liberalisation, and sometimes developing countries must be able to protect their economies. And the only criteria determining the choice should be which policy will do the most to facilitate development. And the key is that developing countries themselves should have the freedom to make those decisions as they see fit. Now, my career choice, for rather obvious reasons, was not modelling. But just for you tonight, I am in fact modelling a shirt made with Fairtrade certified cotton. It's a new product that we're launching in a month's time, hoping to overcome some of the gross inequalities in the cotton sector. Along with sugar and rice, it's a sector where trade urgently needs to be made freer, because at present, US and EU protective trade policies are actively preventing development. In 2000 and 2001, as a result of US subsidies, it is thought that West African countries got 30% below the world market prices, while US farmers got 70% above the world market prices. Now, that's not free or fair, nor is it promoting development, and it needs changing. And it's the same story in sugar or commodity after commodity. So in those cases, clearly, freer trade can be an answer and is necessary. And in other cases, we need to intervene in markets. And I think we should welcome two recent shifts in international thinking, both announced by the Commission for Africa and also by the G8, where they recognise that we have to stop forcing poor countries to liberalise, and we have to give them the space to decide, plan and sequence their economic policies. And one of our goals in fair trade is exactly to shift accepted opinion about where it is right to intervene, where it is common sense to intervene in markets. Even the most radical free marketeer would accept that you need to intervene in some ways, that you need health and safety policies, that you need competition policies, that you need some taxes. In the same way, we want to shift public opinion so that it's completely common sense that you would intervene in trade if you want to facilitate development. And so fair trade is making a difference here and now to the lives of some 5 million farmers across 58 countries worldwide, but it's also helping shift the terms of the debate and, we hope, acting as a successful model of an alternative economics. Now, fair trade was set up, in fact, by coffee farmers after the International Coffee Agreement was torn up in 1989, and after state coffee boards in country after country were disbanded as part of the rush for liberalisation. And it was set up in a direct response to that, and it remains a proactive response to the failures of the free market. Because the key conditions on which classical and neoliberal trade theory depend are absent, both at a macroeconomic level, highly indebted countries have to make short-term economic decisions, but also at the microeconomic level in rural agricultural societies in most developing countries. For example, farmers do not have perfect market information or access to markets or access to credit or the ability to switch production and outputs. So if there is oversupply in coffee, the alternative, they don't have an alternative to switch into. And so they stay in coffee because the alternative is actually total destitution or hardship. And indeed, if anything, if there's an oversupply of coffee and prices have fallen because of free market theories, they're forced into actually producing more and more coffee just to stand still. Now, we shouldn't be surprised about that, because markets have not been designed to deliver social justice. What we have to do then is regulate those markets to ensure that they do that and to redress it. Now, when Tony was invited to speak tonight, he said, "Do you mean fair trade as in chocolates?" So I thought that was very sweet. So I did bring him some chocolates to bribe him a little bit along his way. I'm hoping this will help influence his recommendations at the end. I thought it was also useful to bring a selection of fair trade chocolates to show the selection of policies that we've been trying in fair trade to regulate trade. And so we have policies that do, for example, actively discriminate in favour of disadvantaged smallholders and workers. Policies that do enable them to access markets, to develop long-term relations, to gain more information about how markets work. Policies to encourage the organisation of farmers and workers, to enable them to invest higher up the value supply chain, to ensure farmers have access to credit, and critically, to set a minimum price for their crops, which cover the costs of production with a premium to invest in the future. And it is our experience that farmers often invest in social programs that are necessary for development, such as education or clean drinking water. And they also invest in environmental schemes, and they also invest in building up their businesses, including diversification. So just to give you one example, the Windward Islands are islands that actually face total catastrophe as a result of liberalized policies that are possibly being forced on them. But through fair trade, they've begun to diversify out of bananas into the first fair trade coconuts, which you can now buy, and that they're growing around the corners of their fields. Because the first time they had access to markets, they came, they talked to Sainsbury's and agreed that, yes, they would develop fair trade coconuts for them. And it's just one example of the way in which fair trade is promoting development. And Amos Wiltshire is a very wonderful banana farmer from the island of Dominica who said, "Fair trade has been the saviour of the farmers in Dominica, of agriculture and the whole economy. With fair trade, small farmers have been transformed from marginalised farmers into international businessmen." And that's what we're seeking to do through a selection of different policies. And for different situations, you need different selections. And the key is that this is working. Not only are the chocolates delicious, and the public want to buy fair trade products, but actually they're embracing them and they're showing that the public don't want always the cheapest products at any price. They want to know that the producers are having a better deal and they value and they're ready to pay more for the true value of those products. Now, this evening's debate was organised by the Centre for Civil Society, and I think what's really exciting about fair trade is the vibrant social movement it represents throughout the country, where people are campaigning to see fair trade put into their stores, into their workplaces, and indeed their universities. And I'm pleased to say that LSE is indeed a fair trade university, which means you should be able to get fair trade products here. And because the public want fair trade, so it is also working commercially for companies, for whom it therefore makes sense to offer more products so that more producers can come in. And therefore, fair trade is growing at something like 40 to 50% a year, even in sectors like coffee, which are generally stagnant. And we now have something like 20% of all roast and ground coffee is fair trade. That means one in every five cups of roast and ground coffee that you enjoy, in fact, is fair trade. And that's beginning to have a big impact on the whole industry. We believe, therefore, that fair trade is a powerful living alternative based on high economic, social, and environmental standards. Now, of course, you can't apply those same standards exactly macroeconomically. If half of all the world's coffee beans becomes fair trade, and that's surely where we want to go, then we would need to adapt the model and adapt the policy. But it is a working model, and the same principles could and should be applied to ensure that international trade is managed with only one goal in mind, making poverty history. And it was indeed the usually very free market Newsweek magazine which ran a major piece on fair trade a while back, and they ended by saying, free marketeers be warned, there is another way to trade. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much indeed. And before I forget, please, can you, if anybody's got a mobile phone, can you, in the interests of freeness and fairness, please turn it off? Thank you. And I'd now like to invite Alex Singleton from the Globalisation Institute to give his views.
Well, I think there are two big issues here. One is is free trade and fair trade in an international trade concept, a sort of WTO, World Bank, IMF sort of a discussion. And then there's free trade and fair trade in terms of coffee and chocolate and those sorts of products. It's the voluntary price support system versus the institutions of international trade. I'm going to start off by talking about the institutions of international trade. We heard a little bit about how countries are forced to follow free trade. How are they forced to? Well, one argument is that they're forced to by the WTO. They go along to the Doha round of trade negotiations, and somehow they're pressurized. But it seems to me that they're not really forced to do anything. The WTO works on a one-member, one-veto basis. So any poor country has exactly the same amount of power to veto a decision at the WTO as the United States. And then there's the argument that the countries are forced to liberalize by the IMF and the World Bank. But I think this exaggerates the amount of power that these institutions have. The reality is that when the World Bank and the IMF put conditions on aid to poor countries, they're actually very weak at imposing conditions. What happens is that the countries say yes, or they negotiate. Well, they negotiate first, then they say yes, and then they don't often do what's been required, and then they go back to the World Bank and the IMF and they say, well, we couldn't exactly do that for political reasons, but we did this instead, so give us some more money. I think the forcing is very, very much a misnomer. We heard that India and other countries benefited through protecting their economies. Well, on the whole, the developing countries that became rich in the 20th century adopted a good level of free markets and free trade. India, for 30 years after independence, protected its economy. The result was that millions of people starved, that the industries that were being protected didn't do very well, that the country stagnated. And then the country decided we're going to go down the road of liberalization. They liberalized their economy. They're enjoying some of the world's fastest economic growth. They're lifting millions of people out of poverty. And they're going places. Nobody talks about the need for fair trade for India now. Nobody is concerned about that. Nobody's concerned about fair trade for China. In fact, if you look at what Western charities are saying, it's as though they don't care about China. There are 160 million people in China who are living under a dollar a day, but nobody cares. And the reason is we're pretty confident that they're going to get rich sometime soon. And the reason is China has been liberalizing its economy. It's been welcoming in multinational companies. It's been bringing in inward investment. And it's been going down a free trade route. Most of the Asian tigers went down a good level of free trade, and they've benefited as a result. Of course, China's lifted 200 million out of poverty already, 160 to go. But if we go to the issue, which I've sort of concentrated on in my purpose of the speech, which is on prop-up pricing schemes, the fair trade coffee scheme, chocolate scheme, that sort of thing, what I would say is that organizations like the Fairtrade Foundation lament lowering prices. But on the other hand, economists tend to celebrate them. In the UK, television sets in the 50s cost a lot of money. Most people, if we were here in the 1950s, most of you would not have a television set. But there's been a steady decline in prices. A lot of people in Britain who were making television sets in the 50s have lost their jobs. The trade has moved, the production has moved to South Korea and now China, various countries. And we're going to see, now we're looking at plasma televisions and LCD televisions, and the price keeps on dropping year by year. In a world of free trade, British workers have lost their jobs making televisions. But could we have done better? Had we tried to tame those market forces? We could have set fair trade prices for televisions. The result would have been that TV production would have tended to stay in the UK. Prices would stay high of televisions. Consumption would stay low. Other industries would have received less custom. There would have been less money available for them. Living standards would be lower. And countries that in the mid-20th century were poor, like Taiwan and South Korea, would be poorer as a result as well. In other words, free trade is a win-win situation, except for the television manufacturers. And fair trade is a lose-lose situation, except for the television manufacturers. Free trade, if we were to define it, is a system where production is allowed to move to where it can be most efficiently carried out. The printer on my desk in the office is made in China, not Britain. Production moves to the place where it can be made more cheaply. Whereas fair trade is a system where production is discouraged or prevented from moving to where it can be carried out most efficiently. Fair trade we can use to mean voluntary price support systems like fair trade coffee, quotas like the multi-fiber agreement that was disbanded in January, and tariffs and other types of import barrier. Now, you may think from all this that I'm talking about efficiency, and efficiency is a bad thing. Efficiency is, you know, all very well. It's arbitrary. But is efficiency a good thing? And I'd say yes. Poor countries have lower wages. They have lower wages than we have in this country. China, the wages are much lower than here. So becoming more efficient often means moving production from rich countries or middle-income countries to the poorest countries. By switching production to the poorest countries, it helps raise skill levels and wage rates in those countries because there's more competition for labor. And it seems to me it's the best long-term way to raise living standards. Now we come on to coffee itself. The reason that coffee prices are low is because there's been too much production. It's been an increase of about 15% in terms of production since 1990. Vietnam was encouraged by the World Bank to switch from producing cocaine to producing coffee. Brazil mechanized. And now the fact is that in Brazil, 5 people in a machine can produce the same amount of coffee as 500 people in Guatemala. In effect, if you go down this mechanized route, only a few percent of the world's coffee farmers are actually needed to meet world demand. And so what does the market say? The market says to coffee producers, exit. Does fair trade help them to exit? Or does it encourage them to stay in the market with no future? And importantly, is it actually possible for them to exit? And yes, it's often difficult to switch. The Common Agricultural Policy, one estimate, although I think this is, I'm not sure how accurate this figure is, but one organization put out an estimate that CAP kills one person in the developing world every 13 seconds. It's also very difficult to import freeze-dried coffee from many coffee-producing countries, processed coffee, because there's what's called tariff escalation. If you send in the raw material, that's fine. If you want to send in processed coffee, import processed coffee into the EU, then it's at a higher tariff. And there are also other problems for switching. In many developing countries, it can take as many as 200 days to set up a business because of regulation. There's often a lack of a free market system that allows entrepreneurs to raise capital or to set up businesses. Lack of legal protection, which is required in order to enter into contracts. Lack of access to capital, corruption. But some coffee farmers have switched. In Kenya, coffee farmers, a lot of them, have switched to producing cut flowers. My friend Juna Runga, who has been doing, who's done a couple of BBC series on Africa recently, she's from Kenya, and she tells me that when a lot of the coffee farmers started to switch to producing cut flowers, the government objected and tried to force them to stay producing coffee, and eventually had to give up. And they've switched to producing cut flowers, and they're making a lot more money now. And what does fair trade do? Well, fair trade, of course, pays a few pence extra for a cup. You pay a few pence extra for a cup of coffee. You show solidarity, shows desire to help, to engage in ethical shopping. It's good intentions. But what fair trade does is that it tends to encourage the more affluent coffee farmers to stay in the market. That's why 25% of fair trade coffee comes from Mexico, which is a relatively affluent country where the average income is about $9,000 a year, as opposed to Ethiopia, where the average income is $700 a year. Interestingly enough, the latest fair trade coffee producer, which is Nestle, of all companies, it was announced last week, they're actually going to be buying a lot of its coffee from Ethiopia, which I think is quite a positive step. Do I think that buying fair trade coffee is a bad idea? Not necessarily. If you go and buy Union Coffee Roasters fair trade coffee that's been produced in Rwanda, that seems to me a good thing. They're helping coffee farmers who are poor have access to world markets. They're helping people get up on the economic ladder. That seems to me a good thing. Do I think that going out and buying Cafe Direct coffee from Mexico is very advantageous in the fight against world poverty? No, I don't. On the whole, I think fair trade ignores market signals. It reacts against them instead of helping people adapt. It's a type of managed trade. And the problem with managed trade is that often the people who would win in a free trade system, which are often the poorest countries because they're the people who have the lowest costs, often those people with the lowest costs and the lowest wages actually find themselves excluded from the system. It increases production by encouraging the more affluent farmers to stay in the market. And I have 2 minutes. And it has, at the margin, a very small effect of keeping prices low for people not on the scheme, because it increases the number of people who remain producing coffee. So overall, I would say fair trade coffee doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing if you go out and buy it, but you shouldn't get this sort of unrealistic expectation that it's a great thing and necessarily doing anything better than going and buying a bag of Sainsbury's Ethiopian non-fair trade coffee. I think free trade on the whole is a good thing. I think it's been shown over the last 50 years, over the last 200 years, that free trade has tended to produce the best economic output. It's lifted millions of people around the world out of poverty. It made us, as the United Kingdom, a rich country, made Europe, made America, made the Asian tigers. It's really the force for good that's been working around the world. And that's why I'm so delighted to have a Labour government that is so keen to promote it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. And finally, our next speaker is Professor Tony Venables, representing International Economics LSE.
Great, thank you, Jude. Thank you for pointing out my limited capacity here this evening. I appreciate that. No, as a new civil servant, I do feel nervous about these things. So thank you for pointing it out. Anyway, let me start with the sort of good news on the trade and development front, which is, as has already been alluded to, the fact that in the last 20 years or so, we've seen absolutely historically unprecedented rates of poverty reduction in the world economy. Millions, hundreds of millions of people lifted out of poverty at an unprecedentedly fast rate. Inequality measures in the world economy, standard sort of statistics that economists produce, these inequality measures have started falling in the last 20 years after about 150 years of steady increases. So the good news is this unprecedented, historically unprecedented poverty reduction taking place. Of course, it's been in Asia. Large parts of the world, sub-Saharan Africa in particular, have been left out, passed by. It's happened in Asia. But of course, the relevance to this debate is that a large part of that poverty reduction, the growth in Asia, has been driven by successful engagement of Asian countries in the world economy. And in particular, rapid growth of labor-intensive manufacturing exports. So I think, to frame this debate, it really is important to bear that in mind throughout, that this unprecedented engagement in the world economy and rapid growth that's come from it. Okay, with that as background, the question, of course, is how to use trade so that those parts of the world that have been left out in the last 20 or 30 years, how to use trade so that they too can start a process of similar process of poverty reduction and use trade for their development. So really, while I can see the attractiveness of setting up a debate in terms of fair versus free, this is too serious an issue to be a game of one side versus the other. It's a very, very serious issue of how the success of Asia can be emulated elsewhere and how other countries can be lifted out of poverty at the same sort of rate. And what I want to do in my 10 minutes is talk about some of the ways that perhaps we can use trade, those countries can use trade to achieve that sort of transformation. Anyway, before moving to the argument, I've got to confess that I do have a problem with the use of the term fair trade, because it's used in so many ways by different people. So at risk of going off on a little bit of a tangent, I do want to spend a few moments defining fair trade, or rather shooting down a few silly definitions of fair trade that are, of course, not those of Harriet's. I'll say that now. But nevertheless, I think it is worth clearing the air on this as quickly as I can. Okay, producer lobbies in high-income countries often talk about the need for protection from unfair competition. They talk about fair trade. American manufacturers talk about unfair steel imports from Europe or from Asia. And what they might mean is competition from countries that have lower wages, possibly lower environmental regulatory standards. But I think that use of the word fair trade, and it's not Harriet's use, that use really is profoundly malign. It seeks to close off trading opportunities that lower-income, lower-wage countries might have. It's also profoundly misguided. It's both malign and misguided. The gains from trade come from different economies trading, economies with different underlying characteristics. I don't just mean foreign economies importing in a George Bush way. Comes from economies with different characteristics trading with each other. And of course, if you say, well, we want fair trade, we're only going to trade with countries like us, then that's really to forego most of the benefits of trade. So that's one example where fair trade, the term fair trade, I think is badly abused. Another use of the term fair trade is the idea that somehow we can just change world prices. We can just make world prices fairer. We can move them around. Whether we do that by fiat, by some sort of instruction, or by magic, isn't altogether clear to me. But that is an idea that's a bit prevalent. Somehow we can just change prices. Now, later on, I do want to say a little bit about things that we can do to influence the terms of trade. But I think it's important to get a reality check on this and realize two things. First, that we can't just move prices around by magic. Okay? They are set by some underlying forces. And second, if you do move prices around by magic, or by fiat, or somehow just say, well, yeah, I want to change this price. There's a real danger that that is deeply unfair. Because what happens is, okay, you raise a price, and then some sellers manage to sell at that price, and other people would really like to, but demand's just gone down because we've raised the price. So you get insiders who are getting all the rent, you know, selling at this nice high price, and outsiders who are left outside wanting to sell but unable to because prices have been pushed away from where they might have been. Now, I'm not accusing the Fair Trade Foundation of either of these positions, but I did feel I had to say a few words about, you know, abuse of the notion of fair trade, and I think those are abuses. Anyway, so what is the definition of fair trade that I hope we could agree on? Well, let me set it in the most general sort of terms, broadest terms possible. That is simply trade based around the objective of making the system, making the world trade system work for the benefit of poor people, right? I think that's an objective that we would all have, trying to make sure the trade system worked for the benefit of poor people. Okay, how can we do this? So if that is the objective we want for trade, how can we do it? Well, let me talk about a couple of routes. First, route one. There are some things that we can do to improve the terms of trade that developing countries get for their exports. Let me talk through some of the things that can be done and should be done. One thing we can do is persuade consumers in high-income countries to spend more for products from developing countries. We can advertise them, promote them, and find ways of inducing consumers to pay more. The Fair Trade Foundation has achieved that and transferred a lot of money from high-income economies to low-income economies in so doing, and they're to be congratulated on it. Another thing we can do to improve the terms of trade for developing countries is to remove some of the monopsony power that is undoubtedly in the wholesale retailing system in the world economy, screwing down prices. And once again, the Fair Trade Foundation is to be congratulated for that. That is great. These are good ways of improving the terms of trade. However, the biggest prizes, if we want to improve the terms of trade for developing countries, the biggest prizes really come from trade liberalizations, trade rounds, trade negotiations, trade liberalizations to open developed country markets further. Let me give you some facts, familiar sorts of facts to many of you. The average developed country tariff on manufactured imports from other developed countries is less than 1%. The equivalent tariff on average imports from developing countries is three times that. Still only 3.4%, still low, but nevertheless three times. In agriculture, developed country import tariffs average 18% on imports from other developed countries, 22% on imports from developing countries. Those are small differences, although the direction of bias is pretty clear. Those are small differences. But of course, as we've heard already, they're accompanied by tariff peaks, tariff escalation, various sectors in which high-income countries have had an interest in protecting their industries and where they've managed to maintain protection. Obviously, textiles and apparel are the most one of the most egregious of those examples, although that is being dismantled with the end of the multi-fiber agreement. And also, of course, agriculture. Another fact, processed agriculture, agricultural imports into developed countries often face tariffs 30% higher than tariffs on unprocessed goods. So, there is, despite many trade rounds, trade negotiations, systematic biases, market closure by developed countries to many developing country imports. Against this, of course, developing countries do benefit from the special and differential treatment of one sort or another. The generalized system of preferences, the European Union's Everything But Arms initiative, giving low-income countries tariff-free, duty-free access to the European market. The American African Growth and Opportunities Act. These do give special differential treatment, allowing access. But when you look in the detail of these things, you often see restrictions of one sort or another. maybe these agreements are not guaranteed. They only run for a few years, in which case, obviously, the incentives to actually make investments are severely undermined. Often these agreements are accompanied by rules of origin, meaning that you can only import apparel, clothes, duty-free if the cloth that you use to make the clothes was not imported into your country in the first place. It was also originated in your country. So often in the fine print, in the small details, these things are not quite as good as they look. So my point here is that trade liberalisation, further rounds of trade, the Doha round, are needed to open up developed country markets further in these areas. A further ingredient in improving the terms of trade that developed countries can expect for their exports is, of course, removing some of the subsidies, OECD producer support. Cotton is an example that's been mentioned. The numbers, OECD producer support is now 30% of gross farm receipts in agriculture. Another element on the list, services. Trade negotiations, trade rounds have systematically put some elements of services on the agenda, but not others, with a developed country bias. So these are all areas where trade agreements have been unbalanced and where further changes, further liberalisation is needed. So improving terms of trade is one thing that can be done to make trade both freer and fairer. Another thing that can be done is, of course, working within developing countries to make sure there's an effective supply response in those countries so that they can increase their exports. The list of things here, developing infrastructure, roads, power supply, making markets function better. And here, once again, the Fair Trade Foundation has played a role in improving access to credit. Making sure these developing countries have an institutional framework where firms can profitably invest and the investment climate is appropriate. These are essentially internal matters, but they're all areas where external assistance too can be important, aid for infrastructure, aid for trade reform, these issues. Okay, I've so far talked largely about developing country exports. Let me just spend another minute or two turning to the import side.
1 minute.
What about the more contentious issue then? I mean, so far I've been talking about import restrictions by high-income countries, doing things to promote export growth by developing countries. But what about the most contentious issue? Opening markets, developing country markets, to imports. Well, the point of departure here is that developing countries should use trade for their own advantage. Right? They should not be bullied, forced, set conditions to do things. They should use trade for their own advantage. But what is that? What should countries be doing in terms of opening their markets to imports? I think two important points have to be made. First is that import growth is the flip side to export growth. Right? If you want to really engage in the world market, have export growth, then you have to have import growth. Okay? If you restrict your imports, then your exchange rate will be overvalued and you won't stand the chance of getting your exports growing. So if you want Asian-style engagement in the world economy, import liberalisation has to be a part of that. And of course, there's the history of import substituting economies versus export-oriented, but let me not go into that right now. The second point about market opening, of course, is that my home market is your export market. There is a prisoner's dilemma here. We can't say some countries should open, others not, because each country's domestic market is somebody else's export market. And in particular, nowadays, a very substantial proportion of developing country manufactured exports go to other developing countries. I think I said developed. I meant developing. There's a lot of developing to developing country manufactured trade. So if one developing country closes its market, then that is choking off export opportunities for other developing countries. That must be borne in mind. Okay. Let me just conclude. It doesn't follow from those last 2 points I made that immediate, you know, automatic free trade, complete market opening is an appropriate policy response. There are costs to market opening. Redeploying workers, adjustment costs, loss of tariff revenue, market failures that require intervention. But nevertheless, my point is that effective engagement with the world economy has been shown, I think, fairly conclusively by the record of the last 30 years, the last 50 years. Effective engagement with the with the world economy has been shown to be the route to lifting people out of poverty. And I think that is the route for countries to follow.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank all our speakers for excellent timing. And I'd like to move on now to questions from the floor. And if anybody needs to leave in the next 40 minutes, could they do now so we only have one period of people leaving?
An invitation?
Yeah.
Matt, excellent. We talk to each other.
Get people going in there.
Does it always happen this much?
Okay, well, I do hope some people will stay. Okay,
no,
it's better that otherwise you get people looking up, dribbling out, and it's really irritating. Okay, I'd like to open it up to some questions, and if you have a question, please can you give your name and institution, and please keep your questions brief. And just to say, we're not in Havana, so if anybody's intending to do a Fidel Castro, which means a very, very long speech, please don't do it on this occasion, unless you're Fidel Castro. Okay, thank you. Yes, there's a gentleman at the back. There will be a floating microphone on both downstairs and upstairs.
Hi, I'm Fidel Castro. No, I'm Mike Joffe from Imperial College. In economics, we often talk as though trade was about a buyer and a seller, and it's actually much more complicated than that. And I have a number of comments on that, but I'll just stick to one, which is that actually in practice, there's a whole chain of buyers and sellers from the original producer to the ultimate consumer. And even without the international trade, we actually find that these don't obey the laws of free trade economics. For example, how the supermarkets impose prices on agriculturalists in this country, or pretty much any country that has supermarkets. This actually discriminates, if I can use that word, though I'm not sure it's actually the right word, but it has the effect of making the markup for the poor producers, of whom there are many, at a disadvantage with the buyers or various people along the chain. And Professor Venables did mention monopsony power, but as if that was some kind of market irregularity that we need to do something about. It's actually an inherent part of the system, so I'd like to hear people's comments on that.
Okay. Tony, do you want to?
Having a long supply chain, having many a product go through many different distributors through that supply chain, is no problem at all if that's a cost-effective way of getting it from a farm in Kenya into a British supermarket. It would not be surprising if it went through many stages. I think the problem is if there's monopsony power, if people are exploiting, abusing market power in that process. Now, how frequent that is, how common that is, I don't know. Obviously, there have been inquiries in Britain into market power of supermarkets. One suspects it might be a real problem that needs investigation, and of course needs institutions to undertake that investigation, and they're absent internationally.
Just to say, I'd completely agree that the very complex supply chains internationally do mean that the rules of a free market, which should in theory lead then to people making rational economic decisions, don't apply, because sometimes coffee can change hands as many as 50 times at least before it even leaves the country. And in that case, the farmers know absolutely nothing about what's happening actually globally. If all they know is what price the middleman who comes to their village offers them, and that's all they know. And that's one of the things that we need to change, and that's one of the things we try to change in fair trade. Indeed, a coffee farmer from Tanzania told me that used to be the case. You either sell your coffee or you don't sell your coffee when the buyer arrives. Whereas with fair trade, they're always asking, well, what's the price of coffee in London today? Because their whole horizons have been opened up and they're beginning to have more knowledge, which is what you need if you want to improve the terms of trade. So I think you're right to highlight that problem, and I think it's also absolutely right about the supermarket and indeed the multinational domination of some key sectors, which undoubtedly leads to problems. And I think in this country what we need to do is look at the Competition Commission. Actually, by law, can really only look at the impact on consumers, and that's clearly a complete aberration. They absolutely should have their remit extended to look at the impact on suppliers. And if we do that, then it would be one way that we could help reduce the dominance of just a few companies, which, as you say, the operations of a free market ultimately always lead to more and more concentration of capital.
I think the issue here is the amount of profit that supermarkets themselves are able to make. And there you can clearly see that there is some monopoly power, largely caused by planning restrictions. If you go into, when I go on holiday in France, I'll often see on opposite sides of the road a different supermarket. And you have much more intense competition in many respects. Whereas in Britain, I think we've ended up with quite high-end supermarkets like Tesco and Sainsbury's, a lot of them. Whereas when you go into France, when you go into many parts of the United States, you'll find that when you walk into a supermarket, it feels like it's being done on a much cheaper basis, and that's because there's more competition. But low prices in supermarkets, I think that's great. I think if they're pushing down, just as when we go in and buy a computer in PC World or a fridge in Comet, the fact that people are pushing down prices seems to me a good thing.
Thank you. I'll take a question lot down. Yes, the gentleman down here.
Hi, my name is Ali Fisher. I'm a first-year student at LSE, and I'm not an economist, and I don't know a great deal about economics, but I do read a lot about globalisation. And Alex Singleton, in his speech, mentioned briefly efficiency, which he said was a bad word. So I'm going to take him up on that. He talked about jobs moving to economies where labour costs are smaller or cheaper, and that happening. But do you not think that this will end up being a race to the bottom? Because, for instance, some jobs have already moved to Eastern Europe, then they move again onto another cheaper place, and countries are just competing to lower trade union restrictions, wages, particularly environmental regulation. And you mentioned planning there, and I believe when a Tesco store opens in this country, 2,000 jobs local jobs are lost, and 2,000 local businesses go out of business. And do you not think just removing planning restrictions and things like union restrictions and lowering wages is just going to be a waste of the bottom, and it's completely the opposite to development?
Thank you.
Well, I think that's a very interesting point, and it's a point that gets made quite a lot. It seems to me, though, that actually what we've got is a race to the top. When you look at the countries that have opened themselves up to globalization in the last 50 years, those countries, starting with perhaps Hong Kong, which was a very poor country after the Second World War, it's now the average income in Hong Kong is greater than in Britain. And the reason is it liberalized, it opened up, it went for a complete free market, and it got all the investment in. It had nasty factories to start off with, what we would now term as sweatshops. And gradually over time, the skill set of the workers went up, and the wage rates went up, and now they're richer than we are. And what you actually find is that although low wages are very much an incentive for people to move to a certain country, there's another effect that's happening as well. Investment enables high-waged people to do jobs that compete against low-wage people. And so you see that 81% of US foreign investment goes towards goes to Western Europe, Canada, and Japan, not to to places like Thailand and China. And that's because there are good, you know, there are skilled workers in Western Europe. There's an educated population, and the investment can compensate. The capital compensates for low wage rates. So I don't think it's necessarily the case. I don't think it really is the case that we're on an ever downward trend. So I think what you see is that the low wages are a way of competing in the marketplace. They're your first step on the economic ladder. If you're a poor country, if you're China, and you can work very cheaply, it gets you on the ladder. And from there, you climb up. And then some other people come in at the bottom, and they do the bad jobs, and they start climbing up.
Harry, it's a race to the top or a race to the bottom?
Yeah, I think it's a race to the bottom, and I don't see how you can say automatically, Alex, that low prices are a good thing. They're a good thing for some consumers who can then enjoy them, I suppose. But the key question is, how come we've got those low prices? If you take bananas, for example, the prices of bananas in our supermarkets in the past 3 years fell by 40%, 40%. And consumption didn't rise because we're all eating more bananas now than apples, and we're eating as many bananas as we could possibly eat. The prices only fell because it's a competition between Asda and Tesco to attract the key shoppers. But somebody pays the price somewhere. You know, you can't have those kind of price cuts without passing it back down the line. And the people who are paying the price are the farmers and workers in developing countries. To give you one example, Dominica, I mentioned before, there used to be 11,000 banana farmers in Dominica. There were, until fair trade came along, just 700 left. Social chaos loomed. People were leaving the island in masses. There was a total brain drain, and people were turning to either growing cocaine or going into violent gangs. That's not promoting development. That's a race to the bottom. And it's a race to the bottom that has a huge socially negative effect. Now, I don't blame markets for having those impacts. I think that's why you control them. We shouldn't be surprised that they have that impact, because that's the way they will work, ultimately. So what we should do to say we have to intervene to stop that happening. We have to put a floor so we can encourage the race to the top.
Yeah, you said... You talked about jobs relocating from Europe, whatever, to China or other countries, from high-income, high-wage to low-wage countries. Excellent. Good. Efficiency gains, some of which will be captured by consumers. Employment creation in the low-wage economies. How do we think we're going to raise wages in low-wage economies except by jobs moving there, importing goods from China? This is pro-poor. This is trade doing its pro-poor work of creating jobs in low-wage countries and thereby bidding up wages. Excellent. That's part of what you said. Race to the top, race to the bottom. I think it's context specific. I don't think I can... So I'm going to sit between these people.
Thank you.
Let me give a couple of context. I mean, infrastructure, things like that. It's certainly improved. Countries seeking... to attract jobs, invest in infrastructure, do things, improve some of their institutions to make the location a more attractive location for inwards investment. That's a race to the top. There are other things where maybe there's a race to the bottom. I mean, cutting corporate income tax, chasing corporate income taxes down to zero is not a good thing, but it's context specific.
Thank you. We had a question here.
Hi, Marlies Glacius, Centre for Civil Society. I have one question for Harriet and one for Alex. I wanted to ask Harriet Lam about certification schemes. For coffee, I just about know how to recognise the trademark and therefore which coffee I could trust is proper fair trade coffee. But more generally, in the kind of forest of fair trade, environmental, organic schemes, it becomes more and more difficult to recognise whether actually all these certifications themselves are for real. I used to think that a little dolphin on a tuna tin meant that it was necessarily dolphin friendly, but I've been disabused of that notion. So who certifies the certifiers? Is monopoly perhaps what we need there? And for Alex, the question about, he says that the problem with fair trade is that it ignores the signals to exit a market when it's no longer profitable for you in that market, and therefore you get too many people in it. But I think, as Harriet already suggested, sometimes it's not very clear where they can possibly exit to. There isn't necessarily a viable alternative, except possibly precisely cocaine, heroin, and I imagine you don't want to take your free trade argument to the level that you think that those are the best arguments. So I'd like to hear a more convincing argument from you where these people are meant to exit to.
Okay, Harriet, and who certifies the certifiers?
I think you're absolutely right. I think it is a danger that consumers will get confused between all the different labels and the different schemes that are out there and what they mean. And that's why we work very hard to try to raise awareness of the fair trade mark. There's now one in half the population now recognise the fair trade mark, and we are still the only label that tells you it's fair trade. Now, the little red tractor tells you British producers have met certain standards, there are organic labels, there are different labels for different things, but the fair trade mark is the only one that tells you it really is fair trade. And how are we accountable, if you like, is but we're owned by different charities. In the UK, we're owned by Oxfam. We're part of an international organisation across 21 consumer countries and 58 developing countries, with representation from right across the producers, the consumers and the traders in those countries. And we've also gone for something called ISO's International Standards Organisation, who then checks that we're running our certification system properly. So I suppose they're certifying that we're certifying properly.
Thank you. And signals about when to exit the market, and maybe Tony, you come in here as well.
Well, I think one of the aspects that would be nice to see in the fair trade scheme itself is sort of emphasis on what you do with fair trade producers down the line. At the moment, it seems to me that you get on the scheme and then you stay on the scheme. But should there be a point where you've been on the scheme for a certain number of years and then you get kicked off? Should there be a cut-off on the fair trade schemes that countries earning perhaps over $5,000 a year, where the average incomes are above $5,000 a year, or where a certain percentage of the population is in manufacturing or services? Should at some point the fair trade schemes say, we aren't going to certify people in this country anymore because it's developed as a country to a level which it doesn't need a certificate. It doesn't need to be on the fair trade scheme. We'll allow them to produce coffee, but we're not going to give them a certification. We're about helping people in countries like Rwanda and Ethiopia. And it seems to me that that would be where I would like to see fair trade go. To be honest, I think they're going to do it. I think when we come back in 5 years' time on this, we'll actually see some of these things implemented.
Tony, would you like to comment on exit?
Yeah, the exit to what is a good question, and one that has a slightly broader importance. Obviously, if you do open up imports, some to open up markets, some sectors will contract, and you have to raise the question: where are these workers going to be reemployed? Now, to some extent, the market mechanism takes care of that, but not completely. Assistance of one sort or another is often required, and certainly improvements, once again coming back to infrastructure, investment climate, making sure that the society, the economy is a place where there are incentives to create new jobs is terribly important, and without that there's no potential problems.
Thank you. I'm going to take a couple of questions together from upstairs first of all. There's a person over there. with your hand raised. Can you give us your question briefly, then I'll take one more on this side.
My name is Eric Zdenek with the Government Department, postgraduate. My question is primarily for Harriet. Wondering, I can't help but certainly I feel the inclination to have fair trade to assist those that otherwise wouldn't be able to compete. But I wonder if we had looked back 100 years ago and you selected a few countries that were looking to export and you did adopt a fair trade policy and there were producers who on the world market were not the most efficient producers. Are we best serving them by developing policy, trade policies that may keep them into trade markets that they otherwise wouldn't be in? Is that truly a service to those people and those traders?
Thank you. Another question from the top, the gentleman here.
Hi, my question was for Harriet. I was wondering about the coffee growers. How do you decide what coffee growers get to sell to fair trade? And what percentage of the coffee growers in the world, I mean, what percentage of the market do you cover?
Thank you.
Okay, let me start with the last one. An absolutely tiny percentage. There are 25 million people worldwide involved in coffee, farmers and workers. And so we're obviously reaching a tiny percentage of all those people. And just to also return to Alex's point, that the cooperatives who are already in fair trade and selling fair trade, by and large, are only selling a small percentage of their coffee as fair trade because they're also dedicated to ensuring more people can come in. So all the time we're hoping each new company that comes in or new opportunities that open up, that more coffee producers come in. The average cooperative is selling about 30% of its coffee as fair trade. So again, I think that's another counter-argument to the fact that we're keeping people in production inefficiently or something, because they're not 100% dependent on fair trade. But that is why we need to expand the market so much. And indeed, you know, our objective is to shift the whole coffee market so that we can have a much bigger impact on more farmers. I think they often are the world's most efficient farmers. It's just that we have a complete collapse in coffee prices because we used to have an international coffee agreement that not only set prices, it also regulated supply and demand. When you took that away, you have a complete flooding of the coffee market, and of cheaper and cheaper coffees coming in. And the key then is to help farmers not necessarily move out of coffee, because you can't just do it that easily. If you're up in the Peruvian mountains or the Ethiopian highlands, you can't move into, what do you move into, bananas? Cocoa? I mean, there's all other oversupplied commodity markets. It's a long-term process. The key is to help people diversify and reduce their dependence on one commodity. The second key is to help them move into more value-added areas, into premium coffees, into organic coffees, into coffees that command a premium anyway, or indeed to move into processing. And I think that can happen more as we reform world trade to take down the kind of escalating trade barriers. But it has to be coupled with enormous amounts of investment, and I'd really support what Tony said there. Freeing up the market in and of itself won't suddenly lead to countries moving into manufacturing. There's got to be significant investment in money and education if farmers are going to be able to make some of those shifts. Yes, there were so many different questions, but I hope that covers some of them.
Okay, thank you. The person in pink just here.
Hi, Anna DaCosta from Reuters. I just have a question concerning, all of you use the example of the Asian tigers as the main example, and as Harriet said, a lot of the development was due to protectionism. So just wondering how you think in the current context we could replicate this protectionism and phase liberalization that Asian economies went through in the current context.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Who would like to start?
Well, I think the problem that you have when looking at the history of trade policy is that very few countries follow things in absolute terms. The United States, for example, developed while having external trade barriers, locking itself off from the rest of the world, but then had a huge continental free trade zone. And so it was able to develop in its early stages with external protectionism, but with internal free trade. And a lot of the question is the size of your country. The United States can do that, could do that because it was a big country. Whereas I think when you look at the Asian tigers, on the whole, they liberalized. You see it particularly exaggerated in Hong Kong because it went for a complete liberalization, 100% free trade. But then you see South Korea and Taiwan, they liberalized to some degree, they benefited to some degree. So I don't think it's really true to say that I don't think they benefited from the protectionism that they did. I think they benefited from the free trade. Certainly when you look at China, you can see a great deal of liberalization that's gone on in the last decade. And you've seen a hugely fast economic growth, 9.2 or 9.5% is estimated to be this year. And they're constantly liberalizing. They're about to liberalize their banking system. You know, they're about to privatize 1,300 companies. They're constantly opening up. And of course, it's a process. You don't liberalize 100% straight away. Your economy would crash if you did that. You do it over a number of years. And the countries that have done that, I think, have got rich. Sure, but I don't think we're going to see that for very much longer. It's a process, though. You know, Britain got rich through free trade, but it still had some protection. And I think it's gone down that process of opening up, and I think that's what's been its success.
Tony.
Yeah, obviously, when you look at a lot of the Asian economies, they followed policies that were, in part at least, unorthodox by Washington consensus type standards. China's route was clearly unorthodox. still maintaining a certain number of state-owned enterprises and the fixed peg and everything. Many of the other countries, government activism through the form of investment incentives, export subsidies sometimes protectionism, but rather little. I mean, I'd put it differently, sort of unorthodox and sometimes activist policies rather than protectionist ones. But I think all of them, most of those policies focusing on getting this engagement with the world economy, building exports, becoming outwards oriented, not by instantaneous knee-jerk liberalization, not by following the diktats of the Washington consensus, but just keeping an eye on the bigger picture. How do we create jobs? How do we build new industries? How do we engage with the world economy? So, the lesson from Asia is that is the important objective, but maybe the way you do it is by following some pretty unorthodox policies on the way.
Thank you, Harriet.
I think the problem is, as Tony said before, context is everything, and the context has changed so much. And I think if we particularly look at Africa, which is the continent that's had the falling shares of world trade and where we'd want to really concentrate our attention, the problem is they are now, after decades of liberalisation and structural adjustment, in a very different place from where those tiger economies were. Those really strong growing economies were building them on a base of a highly educated workforce, investing in health, investing in education, investing in infrastructure, all the policies that actually Africa has not been able to do, partly because of structural adjustment and then liberalisation. So I think the first step would be to reverse all those policies and give developing countries in Africa the freedom. I think aid can play a role here in helping kickstart some of that process and ensuring really substantial increased aid flows into Africa and in order to enable them to invest in education. I think we need the reform of the CAP would open up opportunities in things like cotton, for example, for West Africa. I mean, reform of US subsidies. I mean, there are really very easy, tangible gains to be made relatively quickly if we could just get northern economies to open access and stop dumping. And I think allowing those economies that want to protect their nascent industries, to protect more cotton processing within West Africa, for example, would be another key tool. And I think that's what we need to see coming out of the Doha development round. And we've got that chance, and we just shouldn't let it slip away before development slips down the agenda.
Okay, I'm going to take one or two final questions. The lady down here and the lady here. And I'll take these two together. Yeah, if you would like to begin, thanks.
Hello, this is my name is Michelle Hinson-Warren, and I'm a first.
Speak up.
My name is Michelle Hinson-Warren. I'm a first-year student at SOAS. I'm interested that everybody's mentioned infrastructure in terms of development. And what does that mean for Africa, who has a notoriously poor infrastructure? What is going to attract people to invest in Africa in their infrastructure when profit would be so far away before you have to develop the infrastructure before you can actually make trade work?
Okay. Who is going to invest in infrastructure development in Africa to make all of this work? And the final question here.
Thanks. My name is Justina Hart. I'm in the MSc Politics of the World Economy. On the topic of trade liberalization, which everybody is touching on, I'm hoping you could give us some thoughts on very recent events, particularly Robert Portman's article in Financial Times today. There's a piece in the Financial Times by the U.S. Trade Representative today. And in his piece, he talked about reductions in agricultural tariffs in the U.S., and he had been responding to the EU asking the U.S. to do this, and he upped it a little bit, and they said that in response to what he wrote today, that they would also up their reductions in tariffs again. I was hoping you could, all three of you, I guess, give some comments on whether you think these reductions are good, what other changes now need to happen from other developed countries and developing countries, and any thoughts on particularly the domestic forces in the U.S. that led to his sudden shift, because I think those are quite important.
Thank you. So, three quick responses on those two questions. Harriet, do you want to begin? And I'll just go.
Can someone else begin?
Sure. Well, there's a big problem with investments in Africa. There's not a lot happening. Having said that, on my Google News alerts every morning in my inbox, I do find a response about an article about some investment somewhere. So there's some going in, but not as much as we would like. Microfinance has an important key role to play at the small level. It's all very good and well to talk about investments in terms of big projects. But I think the thing that's really going to kickstart African development is actually going to be the small bottom-up approaches. It's going to be having new businesses set up, and we've seen in magazines like The Economist stories about the woman in the village who gets a mobile phone as a result of microcredit and is able to run a business renting it out, and that phone then allows the villagers to phone up other villages and to buy and sell and so forth. So I think it's going to be very simple things like mobile phones, like bicycles. At the Globalization Institute, we're doing a research project on bicycles in Africa, of all things. And the person who's working on that, I think, thinks that would actually be a very important development goal. Very simple, very crude in many respects. We wouldn't really think about it, but actually bicycles do have a part to play in connecting villages. Roads, investments, all these things, very important. Hopefully Africa Commission and increased aid will do something towards that.
Thank you. Tony?
Yeah, Africa. I mean, obviously we don't have all the answers. I mean, if you look at African performance recently, I mean, many economies, most, have now achieved macroeconomic stability and are growing at what are historically excellent rates, 5-6% a year. Many sub-Saharan African countries doing better than they have for decades. But 5-6% a year isn't enough, particularly if population's growing at 2-3%. So obviously something needs to be done to push it to a higher level. I agree with Alex. I mean, some of it will come from the micro detail, from improving agricultural productivity, developing small businesses, having agricultural crops, having better price information, the mobile telephones, getting them to market. But I would also make the point, certainly for the coastal economies, once again, a phrase I've used repeatedly, in engaging with the world economy, labor-intensive manufactured exports. I mean, this is the way that very rapid job creation took place in Asia. Will it happen in Africa? Well, certainly you need to invest the infrastructure, which will be not privately provided, but by aid and assistance and public sector to a large extent. Will that be enough? We don't know. I mean, there are astonishing industries. Lesotho, of all places, employs 60,000 people in the textile industry, essentially for exports, mainly to the US under the African Growth and Opportunities Act. So there are some of these sort of strange sudden spurts of job creation that happen, but it obviously remains a challenge. As for the US trade representative's announcement today, I'm carrying the Financial Times with me and have only read the headline, haven't read the article. It seemed like good news, but without reading the article, I wouldn't want to say more.
And I think on that, the key is really seeing it come through to delivery. I mean, the US was taken to court by the WTO over cotton. The EU's been taken by the WTO court over sugar. And in each case, they still haven't done anything. And I think the key, people are kind of running out of patience, really, for the fine words. And the key is to let's see them really have put in the policies to actually bring down the tariffs and to stop the escalating tariffs, but also the non-tariff barriers. And I think that will help encourage investment into countries like Africa. If people are secure of an export from Africa into Europe, then of course that will encourage it. As long as they enjoy a protected market in Europe or the US, they're going to stay here. So I think that's the only thing I'd want to add to what Tony and Alex have said on that one.
Okay, thank you very much. I think on that note, I would like to close this debate. And I think it's been a very informative evening, and I'm sure if all of you were not sure of your own position before, you'll even be less sure of it now. what we have learned is the real complexities of this. So I'd like to thank all our speakers for their very interesting presentations and very stimulating presentation of their views. Thank you very much.